Don't Give Up Radio Show with Jackie Wayans. Inspiration through word and song for you.
Can y'all help me? Put your hands together. Come on. Can you hear the sound of freedom? We're free because the curse of sin has been broken. And Jesus Christ has set us free.
Overcomers. That's right. You are listening to Don't Give Up Radio. I'm your host, Jackie Wayans, and I'm so glad to be back with you once again another week to encourage you, to let you know in both word and in song that you can make it through whatever difficulty, whatever dark hour you might be experiencing in your life, that it's going to be okay. And I do that by sharing my personal stories, as well as those who I know personally or who have met along the way, who have had wonderful experiences that can turn around and come in and share with you. And so tonight we have with us David Banks, who is lawyer, educator, founder of the Eagle Academy for Young Men. He is husband, father, and I consider him a wise friend and brother in the Lord. David, thank you for being here tonight.
Jackie, it's my pleasure to be here, and I'm just so happy to speak with you and your listeners tonight. Thank you.
Oh, not a problem. I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it. We've had plenty of talks and discussions one-on-one, and when you shared with me that just the beginnings of this book was, you know, in the backgrounds of your mind, and you were just starting to talk about it, and you shared a few things with me, and I thought, this is going to be so powerful, and I knew I wanted to have you on the show back then. So I'm really glad that the moment is finally here. And just before we get into a little bit of who you are, talk to us about the title STORE. I know it the word itself is powerful, but it also stands for something. So just give us a little synopsis on that.
Yes, I'm thrilled that I've had over the years so many people have asked me to do a book really talking about and chronicling the work of the Eagle Academy and the transformational experiences that we've been able to take our young men through. And so I was very fortunate. Simon & Schuster helped to has published this book coming out on September 9th. It's called SOAR, S-O-A-R, SOAR, How Boys Learn, Succeed, and Develop Character. And it's soaring like an eagle, but it's ultimately about, it's essentially a blueprint for mothers and fathers and community members and mentors and others to see just how the Eagle Academy has been able to do the work that we've done in these past 10 years, now working with almost 2,000 young men on our way to 4,000 over the next several years. So I'm very excited about the book, and I'm excited about it because I think it can be a transformational experience for families and communities who will never go to the Eagle Academy, but will have an opportunity to draw from the work that we've done.
Right. I mean, I'm an Eagle mom, for those who are listening and want to know. My son's a senior this year, and I know just from meetings that you just are turning away parents who are just, you know, trying to get in and trying to, there's only so many schools you can open and there's so many places you can be, and I think you're doing a phenomenal job. But the goal is to get these strategies and concepts into the hands of everybody. It's not something that is just like a magic bullet that you found and you can only use for yourself. So I think back to the opening song, Overcomer. And when I think of you, I think of an overcomer. But my first question to you tonight is, was that always the case? And it's kind of a trick question, obviously, but talk to me about who are you as a young man growing up, because your impetus for doing this work has to come from somewhere.
Well, I think there are a number of things that ways in which I would respond to that. First and foremost, you know, I'm a Christian. I believe so deeply in God and what he puts into each and every one of us, that we all have a gift. We all have talents that God has given us. One of the things that I say to the kids wherever I go is that when you think about the vastness of the universe and just how wide it is, and since the beginning of time, you know, God has created all of the people who have been on this earth, and yet every one of us are completely unique to the universe, every single one of us. He's never created anybody quite like you. Oh, he's created people who have your name and they may be as tall as you and look like you and sound like you. But when he created you, he broke them all. There's never been another one exactly like you, and nor will there ever be. And when you think about just how powerful that is, I grew up with that because my mother and father taught me that. And that, you know, God has given us something special, and that I was created for a reason. And I'm not self-created. And so I was brought here to do a work, and that's the work that I'm trying to do. So I've always had that inner strength that has helped me to overcome. And so it absolutely started with my family, and particularly my mom and my dad. I've been very, very fortunate and blessed throughout my life to have them and to have other great mentors. Let me just mention one other thing to you, Jackie. There are two other people who are amongst the people that I acknowledge in the book. One is a woman named Mrs. Mertz. She was my fourth grade teacher. And I remember she wrote on the back of one of my compositions, she said, "I fully expect one day to read, to pick up a book and have it say author, David Banks." And so I have not seen her since I was a little boy, but she's one of the people that I dedicated the book to. And then also there was a woman named Miss Mildred Scott. She was also a teacher that I had in elementary school, but she specifically taught me and my classmates black history and helped to raise our consciousness
about our people, our history, our past, and that has always lived with me, understanding that the people who fought, bled, and died before us, who struggled so that we would have an opportunity, I owe what I'm doing, this work that I do, I owe it to my fathers, as they say, not to my sons. And so I do this really in dedication to those who came before me.
That's fabulous. And, you know, I can relate, and I'm sure so many listening can relate. There's always one or two teachers that there was something about them. They just pulled something out of you, and they just believed in you in a certain way that really just planted a nugget, and that is now blooming. And I love the fact that you say that, you know, you're so fortunate to have two strong parents. And I know from talking to you that your parents are also believers, but they're praying believers. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a second, because you have how many siblings?
I have two siblings, two brothers. I'm the oldest of three. My mom and dad raised three boys. And
That's not an easy thing to do, raising three boys.
Not at all, particularly when you realize that they had me when they were 19 years old, my mom and dad, and then had three boys by the time they were both 22 years old, growing up in Brooklyn. And so it was not an easy task at all. But you talk about overcomers, that's who my mom and dad were, and they had that strength, and they made sure that they transferred that strength to my brothers and I.
Can you kind of imagine back and tell us what a typical day in your house would have looked like, you know, boys coming home from school? You know, what would it have looked like?
My mom was a secretary. She worked for the city and for the state, you know, throughout my life, and was just a wonderful, loving, but very strict and stern. My mother is only 5 feet tall, but she's 5 feet of absolute fire. And so not to be played with, right? I mean, so my mother kept us in line. But we also had a very healthy, godly fear of my father. My father was a New York City police officer, and he did not spare the rod when it came to raising his boys. But he did it in love. He did it in love and made sure that we were on the right path and we stayed in line. And so we were never the kind of kids that hung out all hours of the night. And yet my mom and dad were not overly strict. You know, I had friends of mine who couldn't go anywhere, couldn't do anything. And the parents were so strict that the kids were neutralized. My mom and dad, I thought, had a very nice blend and balance of kind of old school and new. You know, the rules that they set for the house were the rules. But they would explain to us why they were the rules and why, you know, they were good for us. And so it was a house that was filled with love, nurturance, and discipline, all three mixed in, and faith. And so we had really the best, I think, in so many ways of all worlds growing up in Brooklyn until I was about 12 years old before my family moved to Queens. But I'll tell you as an example, you know, my dad made it very clear. Whenever we come home from school, we were never allowed to just run outside and go run and play. We had to do our homework first. That was critical. We never had a TV in our rooms, our entire lives. The TV was in the living room. The TV was in the living room, and the family came together, and we'd have to negotiate what show we were going to watch. My dad would always say, as I got older, kids get all the technology in the room, their own TV, their own radios, their own everything that they want. He said, what reason do they have to come out and talk to you as parents? So, you know, we didn't have all of that stuff, but we had a lot of love, togetherness as a family, and that has the reason why we are all extremely close even to this day.
That's wonderful. That sounds great. I'm curious, though, because I have three, and I know that my middle child is just someone very special. She's full of talent, and she's full of abilities, but she's definitely fits the middle child syndrome, so to speak. And you mentioned there's three of you. You're the oldest. Did that dynamic play out in your household in any way in terms of having, you know, one child that whenever the phone rang, you knew it was, you know, going to be about them, you know?
Absolutely. That was my brother, Philip, the middle child. He was the classic middle child. Terry, my youngest one, was the baby. He got a lot of kind of special attention, I guess, because he was the youngest. I was the oldest. I was pretty mature for my age. I did well in school. I liked school. And so I kind of commanded my own positive attention, if you will. Philip, on the other hand, is the person who I actually opened up this book sore. The very first words in the book are about my brother, Philip, and his transformation, because Philip did not like school. He was bored. He was bright, but he never showed how bright he was from kindergarten through the 12th grade. And he got accepted only to one college, Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. And when the phone would call our house, we always knew it was the teacher calling about Philip, because he would be mouthy with the teachers. There were always issues. He wasn't bad, Dad. He just the light just didn't go on for him until he went to college. And he kind of got away from his brothers, and he was on his own. And then all the good stuff my mom and dad had poured into him. I mean, listen, he had teachers who didn't believe that Philip was really going to amount to a whole lot. And when he came out of college, he followed in my dad's footsteps, and he joined the New York City Police Department. And my father was a lieutenant when Philip was a police officer. And it was a big story because they both had the same name. Philip Banks Jr. is my father. My brother is Philip Banks III. And then a couple of years later, Philip got promoted and became a sergeant, one rank below my dad. A year later, he got promoted again and became a lieutenant. Now you have father and son with the same name, both in the New York Police Department at the same rank of police lieutenant. Another year later, Philip got promoted again and became a captain, and my dad decided it was time to retire. He said the day that you have to salute your own son is the day that it's time to go. And Philip went on to become an inspector, a one-star chief, two-star chief, three-star chief. Today, my brother Philip, that classic little child who most teachers did not think had the potential to do a whole lot, is now what they call the New York City Police Department's chief of department. He's a four-star chief. The only person higher than him is the police commissioner. He's the top uniformed police officer in the entire city of New York. He basically runs the day-to-day operation of the New York Police Department. And that was my little brother, who people would have never thought. And that's why this book talks about him as well. We never know when the light is going to go on. And our job as adults is to keep pouring in all of that good stuff and then leave it up to God and when that light will actually come on.
Wow. You know, I'm just going to go in and play a track right now that I saw you just told. And we'll come back and we'll find out a little bit more about your wonderful book.
Great.
I remember church one Sunday morning. I remember everyone that was there. I got up to sing my song, and the first note came round wrong, but you still shouted, 'cause you were so proud. I remember sharing my hopes and my plans, and there were some people who didn't understand. But you put your faith in my dream, betting all you had on me. You never doubted, 'cause you were so proud. We never had all the finest things, but what we had was enough. There were so many reasons to keep believing that we should be so proud. Now I remember hearing you leave before dawn, then coming home when the street lights came on. Staying up late at night, trying to pay the bills, it was tight. But you kept on, 'cause you were so proud. Ooh, I remember watching you read your Bible, and then crying sometimes when you pray. And now that I am a man, I finally understand how to bow down and still stay proud. So
Graduations and writing parties and all those things. And David, that is a powerful story that you just told about your brother. And I'd like to refocus a little bit and come back to your story. For those of us who are listening, I want to remind you, you're listening to Don't Give Up Radio, and we're here with David Banks, who is educator and author. And David, you went on to college, and while you were in college, like most college students, you had a college sweetheart, and during that time, a shift in plans or a shift in life direction occurred, and I want you to share that story with us, and then we're just going to walk through how God was able to use that to actually begin to mold the direction of your life.
Yeah, I think, you know, so it was a challenge. My wife got pregnant while we were still in college, and so it was during my last year, but it was a major challenge in terms of just, you know, now being a father, even as I'm just trying to figure out how to start my own career. But I think they say, you know, the things that don't break you make you stronger, and so that became my challenge. But it was a challenge for sure. But I also had, you know, a level of inspiration that I was able to draw from, which was my father, you know,
right,
being the dad of three and always being there for us, being just a shining example to me of what a good dad is supposed to be. And so I really wanted to make sure that I was doing that for my children, which ultimately we wound up having four children. My oldest son is 28 years old now and lives in Virginia. I have a set of twins, Aaliyah and Ali, who are graduates of, Hampton University and Morehouse College. And my baby boy, the youngest, is 20 years old now and just finished his third year at Morehouse. Yeah.
All right.
So no more babies. Everybody's grown. And I told everybody that their responsibility was to come home and put their diploma or their degree on the wall. That's the price of admission for living in my house all these years. And so, so you set the expectation, and then you provide the love and the nurturance for your kids to minimally meet that expectation, and hopefully even go beyond that. I've been blessed, and I did not use the fact that I had children early as an excuse for not being able to go on and continue to pursue my dreams and doing what I was supposed to do.
Well, that's, you know, part of what I want to get at, because I think, you know, especially for the listeners, we all have bumps in the road, things that we didn't expect to happen that occur. And the idea is that initially our feeling is that maybe we should just throw in the towel. Maybe we should just give up on that dream, give up on life. People make really poor decisions when they're in a moment of distress. And I remember you sharing with me a wonderful story. I think you were on a beach and you were just sitting on a bench and you were just asking God some real questions. And it was in that moment of time that things began to gel for you and you began to hear exactly what you were supposed to be doing with your life. Can you share that with us?
You know, I was working for the New York State Attorney General's office, and it just became clear to me. I asked God, really, I was on vacation and sitting on a beach in the Dominican Republic, and I remember just spending day after day by myself on the beach with the roar of the ocean and the waves rolling in, and just talking to God and saying, you know, what is it that you would have me to do with my life? Where am I supposed to be so that I'm living a very purposeful life? And during those few days that I was away, it really came to me that my gift, my talent, where I was supposed to be, was in education and working with young people. And that's the way I was going to have the most fulfilling life and the most purposeful life. There were a number of things that I could have done and a few things that I did. But in terms of where I was really supposed to be, now, I didn't plan on doing that. I didn't plan on going to school to be an educator. And I decided that what I would do is, because I was actually a teacher during the day while I was going to law school at night. But I didn't think I was coming back into education. But God made it plain to me that I was supposed to come back. And it was also clear that I, instead of just being a teacher, that I was supposed to be a leader and be an administrator. And so I had to go back to school to be a school leader. And I'll tell you this. I left the Attorney General's office on January 1st, and I wanted to be in a school in September, which basically meant that I only had one semester, and basically to get another master's degree. And you needed 30 credits to get a master's degree, but I found out, I called the state, and I found out you only needed 24 credits to get your state certification so you could at least start out as an assistant principal in the New York City school system. And I went to Brooklyn College, and I spoke to the people there. They only gave me 15 credits to start, which meant that I was going to need to take a whole year to get it done. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do it all in one semester. And, Jackie, I went home that night, and I woke up in the middle of the night with God basically telling me, he said, who said you have to take all the credits at the same school?
Mm.
And where does that come from? And so, long story short, I wound up going to Brooklyn College, City College, and Baruch College all at the same time on different days and different nights, and took all 24 credits in one semester and then was in a school in Brooklyn as an assistant principal. That's only God. I'm willing to do the work, but God will give you the light, inspiration, and open the door, and that's what he did, and I did the work to walk through the door.
Wow. I'm so glad that you shared that, and only you could share it in the way that you did, because all of us who are doing anything on a successful level, you know, people only see you in that place, in that space, but they really don't understand the toil and the sweat that it takes to get there. And anyone who's listening that has a dream, I need you to understand that it will take work on your part, but the most important piece of that is your faith in God's ability to open the doors and to give you the wisdom that you need to move from one step to the other. In fact, I think of Isaiah 40:31, which I'm sure, David, you know very well. It says, but those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. And even in just saying that and the word eagle being there, I want to transition to the book Soar and talk about a couple of the chapters that you have in there. And one of the chapters that stood out to me was your friend, your life. And I wanted to find out what you're expressing there, because having a young son myself and knowing how important it is to make good decisions, I wanted to know what exactly are you delving in there and what are you trying to teach us?
Yeah, I think it's this notion of of peer pressure and the fact that our sons, you know, really have such a heavy reliance on their peer group. And in many ways, the peer group today, more so than it did 25 years ago, the peer group plays a much more significant role in many often, even than the parents do during the teenage years, or even the church does. You know, kids, the culture that they're coming up in now, they have such a heavy reliance on being accepted by their peers. And that particular title itself really kind of came from the principal of our school in Brooklyn, Rashad Need, you know, who was really kind of faced with some significant challenges in his own life growing up in Queensbridge houses, and ultimately realizing, like, you know, it's your friends or your life, you know. Sometimes your friends can, in fact, take you down the wrong path. And so we've got to teach our kids about how to make the right kinds of choices, and we have to have our parents providing the absolute best safe passages that they can provide, really, for our kids and for our young men, all of our children. But our young men seem to be very susceptible to the streets and to the culture of the streets. And mm-hmm. so, you know, it's important even as parents, right? I mean, my mom and dad, and I did this, you know, with my children. I mean, I knew who their friends were. And so you have to exert a level of influence around that peer group. You can't allow the peer group to raise your kids or allow the streets to just raise your kids. You've got to play a much more significant role in doing that. Even as they get older, we should not fall back and think that our job as parents only happens when the kids are in elementary school. As they get older, we still need to play a very, very big role, and increasingly a big role, even as they progress through the school system.
Now, what are some of the ways that, as parents, we can bring that message across to them that, you know, your friends are your life? You know, you can have one wrong association, and that could mean that you either wind up in jail or on drugs or, you know, your life is lost. How do you communicate that effectively?
Well, it's something that we talk about, which is what we said is kind of creating a conspiracy of care, right? First of all, just starting with the resources that you have right in front of you. As my pastor always says, there are blessings all around us. And you got to – but sometimes those blessings won't manifest themselves unless you reach out. And so you've got to take advantage of what's in your neighborhood. Yeah, many of us live in challenging neighborhoods, and, you know, your neighborhood may not have all the resources that some other neighborhoods that may be more economically advantaged have, but every neighborhood has some place where you get some benefit. There are good people in all of these neighborhoods. There are community organizations. As parents, we have to take the initiative of finding those resources in our community and making access, you know, taking access to those things. You know, when I was a little boy in Brooklyn and I was, you know, 10 years old, my mom and dad signed me up for a little local museum that was called the Muse. And that's where I learned kind of an introduction to photography. And I used to go there every Saturday morning. And it was a big deal for me just learning how to do that and how to create photographs. But for my parents, it was just keeping us busy, keeping us off the street, reducing the amount of idle time that we had. And yet, I'll tell you this, I have a cousin who lived right across the street from the Brooklyn Museum and the Botanical Gardens and Prospect Park, and I would bring my kids there all the way from Jersey when I was living in Jersey, and I would bring my kids there on the weekend, and he lived right across the street with his three children, and they never visited the museum. They never went to the Botanical Gardens. They hardly ever went to Prospect Park or to the zoo. And I said, all of these blessings, they're right in front of you. Why are you not taking advantage of these things? And so, you know, that's what I mean when I say parents have to take advantage first and foremost of the community resources that are right in front of your face. But you've got to go out, got to get up, and you've got to activate those resources in order for them to work in the lives of our children.
You know, David, as you're talking, I'm thinking even from a professional standpoint with your career, I'm having a little flashback moment here because I've known you professionally for over 12 years now, and you started as the principal of law, government, and justice, and you came to a point actually in your career, both professionally and personally, I would say, that you could have really just sat behind your desk. You've accomplished enough. You had a great school, that you did wonderful things connecting them with the judicial system here in New York City, and you really were at the height of what one could consider, you know, being a successful principal. And I remember you saying to me, well, actually, I'm going to leave and start this new school for our boys, for our Latino and Black males, and it was based on a report that had just come out, and also your years of experience of seeing pretty much what you've just said. You know, there are parents who just, they want the best for their kids, but they don't have the skills necessarily or the components in putting that in there. I want you to kind of go back to the moment that made you decide that you were going to take this on and take on, you know, the Eagle Academy for young men, and also that overflow that goes into this book as well. What is it that's really driving you? Because, you know, we all see this happening around us, and sometimes I think we just get so anesthetized to the fact that our boys are failing.
I'm, you know, Jackie, I'm very much a believer, you know, and I'm very much a person of deep faith, and that God just has this kind of abiding love for us and purpose for us. And I'm very much in touch with that, and I think that's what guides me. And so while I was very content, I was the founding principal at the Bronx School for Law, Government, and Justice, moved that school from a shared space into a $75 million state-of-the-art building, and could have stayed there for a long, long time. I was very happy. I had some of the happiest years of my life there with the people I worked with and the lives of the young people that we transformed and the parents that we worked with, the educators. It was great. And in fact, when the idea of creating the Eagle Academy for young men as the first all-boys public high school in New York City in 30 years came up, I had no intention of being the principal. I was going to help out. We interviewed almost 20 people to be the principal. When I say we, I'm a member of the 100 Black Men organization in New York, and we were the founders of Eagle. I'm often referred to as a founder because I was the most visible, and I really became the face of it. But it was our organization and a series of men who really played the key role in getting the school up and running. I participated in interviewing a whole host of people to be the principal, and we narrowed it down to two. And the final two candidates, for different reasons, could not assume the leadership position. And it was when that happened, when the second guy called me. And I was home one evening, and to tell me why he couldn't take the position, that's when I sat and I got on my hands and knees and I prayed. And that's when I felt like God said to me, this is a position that I've created for you, and I'm supposed to do it. And that's when I figured out that I had to leave the position that I had at my current school, Law, Government, and Justice, and move over to do this work to try and transform the lives of our boys, or as we say, saving our sons. And so this is very much a mission-inspired work for me. This is not a job. This is I feel like something. You know, my dad always told me that our time on earth is very short. It's but a vapor in the grand scheme of things. We're only here for a moment. But while you're here, you're here for a reason, and you're supposed to do something. And so now I'm very clear what my purpose is, and God has made this clear. This is my work. This was why he created me, to do this work and to help to transform the lives of our young men. And in doing that, we're going to help to better our families, strengthen our families, and better our communities. And that's a job that's been left to me. I'm not the only one to do it, but certainly this is a work that he wants me to do, and I do it willingly.
Wow. I'm just going to take 2 minutes and play a little bit of this track called Grown Men Don't Cry. And, of course, that is not the case. The young man who produced it, Stevie Fright, is one who has overcome a lot of difficulties himself, being a young man born of 10, escaped the street due to his faith, and now he's really using rap, the rap forum, to get a really positive message across.
As saints, we're taught to trust God and press on despite the circumstances. I think some people truly believe that we just suppress our humanity. But yo, we walk around in real pain, reeling from affliction, rejection, infirmity, frustration, daily striving as we go on to perfection. Yeah.
They tell me grown men don't cry, stuck in the days, years falling, nigga, I can't hide. Broke inside, then the word from heaven don't hide, cause it's a struggle and the strife, Lord, I can't die. They tell me grown men don't cry, stuck in the days, years falling, nigga, I can't hide. Broke inside, then the word from heaven don't hide, cause it's a struggle and the strife, Lord, I can't lie.
Some days it ain't enough, all the hands open, intercession prayers, oh joy when I stand hopeless. Sometimes I carry broken thoughts on so I can't focus, random and spoken words, observing the tense moments. Out of the flesh I feel the power, the grand atonement, the blood with the standing holding the mirrors till a man is folded. My friends that I have to roll with can't handle the stress I cope with. Covers are twisted, tossing that night till I'm sweating coldness. It's murder in these streets, these children are stand with boldness. Questions and pistol playing, they show them which hand to hold with. Wanting to listen, but they come back like I'm active poachers. Message rejected, I'm inside torn in the face I'm showing. Acceptance, those are the feelings since I wasn't blessed with. Social charisma, echo for choosing the path of testing. Failed a few times, but I learned some lessons. Got a few scars in my heart while I'm writing. Heal me cause I'm affected.
They tell me grown men don't cry, stuck in the day, tears falling and I can't hide. Broken inside, send the word from heaven don't hide, cause it's a struggle in this life, Lord, I can't lie. They tell me grown men don't cry, stuck in the day, tears falling and I can't hide. Broken inside, send the word from heaven don't hide, cause it's a struggle in this life, Lord, I can't lie.
Fake friends and family shake hands, whisper vague plans.
Grown men don't cry. Well, no, we grown men do cry. And David, I'm thankful for the way in which your cry is coming out. You know, there's cries that are wallowing in self-pity or wallowing in being overwhelmed that there's nothing that we can do because the situation is so vast and so broad. But you allowed God to speak to you and show you exactly how you can effectively cry out in our society and make a difference. Now, coming back to the book Soar, you talked about the conspiracy of care, power of love, security, and high expectations. And I noticed you use the word high expectation as opposed to just expectation. When you say that, what are you defining there?
I'm defining the fact that you have to imagine the most, you know, for our kids. I knew some friends of mine whose expectation for their children, and these were really good, God-fearing people, but their expectation for their kids was just that they graduated from high school. And each one of these kids had so much more potential than just that. But that was the expectation that was set in their household. And they met that expectation. Every one of them graduated from high school, and none of them went on to college or graduated from college. And it had the expectation been, you know, to the very least to graduate, you know, from college, they would have done that. They would meet the expectation, but that was not the expectation that was set. And so, you know, a lot of families we know are just, I just want my daughter to just get married one day and find a good man to help take care of her. You know, I mean, that's an expectation, but I don't consider that a high expectation when you realize that your daughter has the potential to go on and be a scientist or be a doctor or do something to help transform the world, and you're just hoping for her to meet a nice guy that's going to take care of her. You know, that's not – so it's really about that. It's about setting those much loftier goals because our kids have the potential.
They really do. They just need us to believe in them and to see us, see them in that way. And when you
right.
do, it makes all the difference in the world.
And going back to your brother Philip, I believe that was the case with your parents. They, despite everything that the teachers said year after year after year, it never changed their focus in terms of what they believed, who he could become.
Absolutely. They always knew that Philip had what it took, but they knew that Philip was put here probably for a reason, to keep them on their toes. And because I was pretty easy for them. You know, I liked school. I did well in school. My younger brother, Terry, was pretty much the same. And Philip was the one who was a challenge. And so, you know, most parents would say if they got more than one child, they got at least one that they would say, okay, this is the one I've got to pray about the most. This is the one that's the most, you know, of a challenge to me because he's not making it as easy. He doesn't listen clearly as maybe the other ones do.
Right.
But that's what it is. They're all about children are different. They're all different. And I'll tell you what else. Our parents, their job is to provide safe passage for their kids. As parents, we don't own our children. You know, we didn't create them. We were vessels that we used. And they have a purpose in their lives. And our job is to provide them safe passage during this journey, not to control them, not to limit their potential of who they ought to be. And we have to understand our role. We have to play that role very seriously.
Well said. And to go along with the previous point you were making to that, I'm thinking about the other chapter that's called I Will Stand Up to You, Discipline to Teach, Not to Punish. And there is a difference. And as you're talking about always believing in a child, though they're a challenge, sometimes parents lose their way in the balance of that. And I know for myself, it definitely got harder between middle school to high school because there's a transition in terms of how you discipline and how you communicate. Please enlighten and help and share. What are some of the tidbits that you have in that chapter?
I think that, you know, parents have to understand, and not just parents, but educators who are working with our kids in the schools, you know, have to understand that our kids are going to test you. I mean, it's part of what it means to be a kid, and many of us did the same way. And we can't blink as adults when our kids challenge us, you know. And so, you know, and they've got to know that we're not afraid of them. You know, kids respond based upon relationships. And when kids see as a teacher that you're afraid of them, the game is—it's already over. You cannot teach them, and the kids will take full advantage of you. And because at that moment the kids are now in charge, and kids know if we're in charge, everybody's in trouble. This is not going to work. and so it's important. Again, it kind of speaks to this notion of expectation, but it's about how do you get to know the kids? You've got to invest and getting to know them, and understanding that discipline is really not, it's not about saying, you know, we're going to suspend you or anything like that. It's about saying that when you do wrong, there's going to be consequences for it, but you have to also use that as teachable moments and explaining, you know, what it is that you're doing, why they have to be disciplined, and all those things really do make a difference. But it really is based upon, you know, relationships. But kids want to come to school. They want to know that they're in a safe place. They don't want to run amok, and they don't want to see that you're allowing other people to run amok. But they also don't want to see that, you know, you're throwing kids out of school because they suck their teeth at a teacher or something, and then all of a sudden they get a sense that the whole system is unfair.
Right.
And then you're just fighting with the kids all the time, and that's not what it should be. It's about how the kind of culture that you create.
Our time is moving so quickly. In one sentence, could you kind of describe why Eagle has been so successful over these 10 years and really outperforming the city standard in regards to graduation rates of our young boys and even most recently the Regents exams? What do you think it is?
Oh, I know what it is. It's culture. It's culture. And what's wrapped up in that word culture is this notion of how we believe in our kids, that we do set high expectations for them. Let me give you an example of what I mean when I say that, Jackie. I just received an honorary doctorate from the faculty at Wheelock College in Boston last week. With three of our young men graduated from Wheelock College. And when they presented me and had me come to the middle of the stage, and I'm flanked by two people, one who is a member of the faculty there at Wheelock, who grew up in the Bronx, and another gentleman who was on the Board of Trustees. And they stood there, all three of us, in our cap and gown, as I got ready to hear the president of the university kind of talk about the great work that we've done at Eagle and the way we've transformed lives. And before she could say a word, the young men from the Eagle Academy who graduated from Eagle and have now were graduating from Wheelock stood up in the middle of the auditorium in their cap and gown on their graduation day and began to recite the Eagle Pledge, which we call Invictus. It loud and turned out the entire auditorium out of the night that covers me. Black is the pit from pole to pole. I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. And they went on to do that poem and created a standing ovation for people who said, it was an unscripted moment. And in that moment, Jackie, what they were saying to me was the seed that you planted in us, creating the school where people believed in us and teachers gave us the support that we needed. We may not have understood it then. We get it now. I knew these young men when they were in the eighth grade, coming to Eagle in the ninth grade, and I had them over the course of 4 years. And even after I left as the principal and I stayed in touch and I would see the culture had already taken and the culture continued, the traditions continued. So they are Eagle brothers. And they looked out for each other on this campus, all three of them, and made sure that they helped each one of their brothers get to the finish line. And they looked at me in that moment as they said that poem with a smile on their face, essentially saying, we get it. We get it. We got it. And we're going to take this for the rest of our lives. We're going to go on to do what Eagles are supposed to do. It was the most unbelievable moment, personally, that I probably ever had in my life. My mom and dad were there, and it was just incredible to be a part of that, and it just said, wow, in 10 years, this work has really been transformative. And that's what the success of Eagle has been about. We planted the seeds in these young men that they're to be leaders and that we believe in them, and they got it. And that's what Eagle is all about.
Wow. David, our time has already slipped away. I want you to do some important things before we bring the show to a close. And the first thing is the book. I want you to tell us again when it's coming out, but it's on pre-order right now. And I want people to understand why pre-order is important. It's not just about sales and numbers, although, David, you can tell us why it might be important in this particular case. But it's also the fact that there's so many books out there that are on the bestsellers list, that are, you know, on the top 10, and they are not really bringing anything of lifelong value to you so that once you close the book, you have something to implement to change your world, to change your life. This book, whether in the hands of a parent, educator, or community leader, this book is something that will give you that fuel. And I know that the more of us that support this work and pre-order it will get it into that, you know, those bestseller lists so other eyes can see it and know that it's there and it exists, because there's so many books on the bookshelves and it's so competitive, and we want to make sure that SOAR is on the bestsellers list, and that's why the pre-order is so important, you know.
That's right.
Tell us where
that's
we can get it and how we can, you know, pre-order it now, and also tell us where we can find out more about Eagle Academy.
Yes. Well, you know, when you think about the fact that, you know, in New York State alone, 75% of the inmates for the whole entire state correctional system come from seven neighborhoods in New York City. You know, the fact that almost 70% of our children, black children, are growing up without their fathers. It's a real crisis. It's a real crisis. And yet we can do something about it. And I think this book that we've written, it will really serve as a blueprint. You know, the Eagle Academies themselves, and we're now, we're going to open our our sixth academy this September. We're going to be in Staten Island, which is going to put us in every borough in New York City. And so those schools really serve as a beacon. But the book itself will serve as a blueprint to show people the way and how they can, in fact, do this work and help to transform the lives of their own sons. And schools who read the book, you know, the young men who they're engaged with and working with and trying to do better by in their schools, this is the blueprint. And this book, we shared experiences through the eyes of several of the young men who've gone to Eagle, and teachers and others, mentors. Here it is. And it can be, we think, an extremely valuable resource. It comes out on September 9th. It hits the bookshelves. But if you order it as a pre-order now for $20, you can order it through Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. You can get the book, and you'll get the book 2 to 3 weeks earlier than everybody else will receive it. All the proceeds of this book are going back to the work that we're doing with our young people at the Eagle Academy. So it's about lifting up who we are, what we're doing. But, you know, it's important, I think, that this book become a bestseller, because if it becomes a bestseller, that means that communities across this country are getting access to something that will be a real valuable resource. This is not a book that's just like a little Harlequin, you know, love story. This is about this is a book that's really something that you can really use and can transform. And this is not just for the parents or even the churches or even teachers, but the business community. You know, people should read this book, because we should all recognize that we have a vested interest in making sure that we get our young men off the sidelines, get them into this game. Our country cannot be economically competitive if black and Latino males are not part of the solution and part of being contributing members of society. It just won't happen. And so we all, our destiny is really tied together, and this is a book that will give, I think, some real strong information and inspiration to help people to understand how we can do this even better. For further questions, you can reach us at the Eagle Academy Foundation, .org, and our website there will direct you to more information about the book and more information about the work that we're doing at the Eagle Academy, at the EagleAcademyFoundation.org.
And I also have the link provided on Blog Talk Radio if you're listening to us here. David, thank you so much for being with us and sharing this journey. It's been very rich.
Thank you so much, Jackie, and I really appreciate you inviting me to be a part of it.
Not a problem. I want those of you who listened, and if you enjoyed what you heard and you'd like to know more about Don't Give Up Radio, you can find me on Facebook under Don't Give Up Radio, and I'm also on Twitter, Jackie Wayans. I'm right there for you. Next week, we are going to have one of the original supermodels from the 1980s joining us. She was right up there, one of the first on the covers of Vogue with Cheryl Teagues and Beverly Johnson. We're talking about Wanaki. She will be here to talk about how her faith helped her through the modeling industry and through life. And so we look forward to you joining us. And until then, I want you to continue to be your own best hero, because there is one who's the greatest hero of all who gave his life for yours. You were born a winner. We're going to go out on that. Hey!
Just